Here we go. Okay. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the LSE and to this public lecture hosted by the Department of Government. And it's my great pleasure to introduce this discussion of bullshit and post-truth politics. My name is Jonathan Hopkin. I'm an assistant professor in comparative politics in the government department. My connection to this topic, I work on comparative European politics, politics of inequality. I'm also currently writing a book on populism, but I've recently published an article on post-truth politics, bullshit and bad ideas in new political economy with Ben Rosamund of Copenhagen University. So it's not, I was the obvious shoe-in for this role of chairing, and it's a great pleasure to be able to present. We have four great speakers who all have an interest in these concepts to speak to us this evening. I'll briefly introduce them. They're going to talk for around 10 minutes each, and then after that we're going to have time for Q&A, for discussion with questions from the floor, and we should be done by about 8 o'clock. So I'd like to introduce, first of all, we have Tanya Filer of the University of Cambridge, who is has been working on a conspiracy and democracy project there, and she's interested in digital technologies, democracy and political information, has also done work on the politics of conspiracy in Argentina. So she'll be going first. We also have Matthew D'Ancona, well-known British journalist, of course, writes a weekly column for The Guardian, has written for several newspapers, was formerly editor of The Spectator, and he published a book last year called Post-Truth, The New War on Truth and How to Fight Back by Ebru, from Ebru Press. Juliana Reinecker is a professor at King's Business School, she's working in the fields of international management and sustainability. She has an interest in what she's published very widely on a range of topics, sustainability, global governance, corporate social responsibility, values and valuation. I could go on. She's published an incredible amount. And very, very distinguished. She's also Associate Dean for Impact and Innovation, I believe, at King's. So, we also have Andre Spicer, who is Professor of Organizational Behavior and Founding Director of Ethos, the Center for Responsible Enterprise at Cass Business School, just down the road. And he's the author of a recently published book, Business Bullshit, of which I believe there will be copies available for purchase, and Andre is kindly offered to sign copies after the talk. He's the author of several other books, including The Stupidity Paradox. So this is a fascinating subject. It's not at all as frivolous as it might appear at first sight. So we're going to listen to the speakers and then have a discussion. There is, I'd like to remind you all to turn your phones on to silent, but you are allowed to tweet, and there is a hashtag BS politics if you want to comment on what you're hearing. And this is also being recorded. There should be a podcast available at the which will upload it onto the LSE event site a few days, hopefully after this talk. So, no more from me. Let's hear from our panelists. I'm really looking forward to hearing what they have to say about the state of bullshit in politics. Please join me in welcoming the panel.
Just Well, as Jonathan mentioned, for the past few years I've been working on the Conspiracy and Democracy Project at the University of Cambridge, which is a six-year venture. It's in its final year at the moment, and it's based at the Centre for Research in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities. And it's an interdisciplinary project, so it brings together engineers, historians, philosophers, to think about the relationship between conspiracy theories, and democracy. And when it started, so just over 5 years ago, people thought this was a bit of a strange topic of study. Now, obviously, in the past couple of years, that's not the case so much anymore. But it's been a really interesting project to be part of. I don't want to talk too much in depth about our research findings around that this evening. But what I want to do instead is to think about some solutions to this sense that there's a problem, a sense that our information environment is disordered at the moment. Because that's something that I think across the board, whether you talk to policymakers, scholars, users of social media, there's a real consensus around that. And yet what there isn't consensus about is what to do about it. So I'd like to just explore some areas in which we might start to think about solutions to that problem. But if you are interested in the project, then do have a look at our website to find out more information about the research side of it. So the areas that I'd like to think about are these four. The first is to say that we need to be moving beyond the language of fake news. So the problem, I think, with fake news as a term is nobody really knows what it means. It's mobilized in very amorphous ways, and I'm not just talking about the distinction between Trump using the phrase fake news versus people who perhaps do not support Trump. I'm thinking about more in-depth categories of misinformation and disinformation. So this diagram is produced by First Draft, which is an NGO that works on mis and disinformation. And it suggests a number of categories that we might divide it into. And I think this is a good starting point, because what it lets us do is divide between categories of mis and disinformation that actually are just crucial to democratic discourse. So, for example, satire and parody. And those that actually might cause harm, and where we might want to think about regulatory strategies rather than just, let's say, digital literacy. So with something like false connection, where headlines, visuals or captions don't support the content, actually it might be about education and thinking about digital literary skills. But something like manipulated content, there might be a regulatory argument for. So once that we can divide mis and disinformation into more specific categories, we can start to think about strategies for dealing with it, for tackling some of its problematic areas, and actually making sure that we safeguard some of the more useful areas of it. So the second thing I'd like to suggest is that we broaden our topics of study, our topics of media discussion, beyond Europe and the US when we're thinking about mis and disinformation. So the graph I put up shows the use of electoral bots, so automated accounts on Twitter, in the 2015 presidential elections in Argentina. And actually both of the main competing parties used them quite extensively. So this is pre-Trump. We could also look to Brazil in 2014 and other earlier examples. And they show very clearly the same uses of technologies to misinform or disinform as we saw with Trump but earlier. And in fact, what I would say is that although obviously the scale of usage was different, the use of technology was exactly the same. So really what was new was the media reportage of it around Trump rather than the act itself. So I think that if we start with a broader global perspective on these issues, then we need not to be as surprised as perhaps we were around the time of the Trump election. The next thing I want to suggest is really about experts and policymakers and the kind of language we use when we're talking about complex subjects. So clearly we're living through a climate of distrust in expert knowledge. And some of that has been related to kind of the history of usage of economic data and economic predictions that were presented as facts and turned out not to be true, not to hold. There's a problem here in that self-perceived experts in one area are more likely to think themselves experts in lots of others. Now, I think that's particularly problematic at the moment when we're thinking about the future and the technological future, which is a zone of uncertainty. And yet, the way it's talked about is often in very factual terms. It's not always clear whether something's an opinion, conjecture, hype, or fact. So I've put up a few examples here. They're presented in rather factual terms. The future of education is teacherless. The future of augmented reality will be boring. VR gives us the ability to leverage the power afforded by all prior creative mediums. Now, these seem to be acts of overclaiming to my mind. And I've put up another example where I think the balance is struck more carefully. There's a real subtlety here. So general AI, artificial intelligence, is the big dream of AI. It's my belief that that is not in sight at the moment. It doesn't mean it's impossible, but it's not in sight at this moment. That's from Michael Wooldridge when he was giving evidence before Parliament. So I think we do need to be really careful and inject a bit of intellectual humility and provisionality into the claims that we make, particularly around the technological future. And of course there are concerns that communicating uncertainty will erode trust still further. But I think we do need to explore the possibility that making a greater effort to communicate uncertainty may actually improve the quality of policy making and public discourse. And then the final and related point I want to make is about the kind of worship of the fact that we also see, I think, quite a lot of at the moment. I've put up a picture of Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, but I could have chosen myriad other populist leaders who are extremely talented at making extreme emotional bids, both online and offline. And I think the intuitive reaction is sometimes to retreat into a defense of facts, or occasionally to attempt to match the kind of extreme emotional offerings such as fear and veneration. But often it's about saying, we don't do these political narratives, we go for facts instead. But the thing is, populist leaders don't just sow fear, they also offer themselves up as the ultimate protector, creating a sense among their followers of not being alone in a fragile and dangerous world. So it's not just the fear they evoke, it's also this sense of awe and veneration. Facts alone don't necessarily offer that comfort. They also don't acknowledge that politics is inherently emotional. So if I can end with a provocation, it would be to say that rather than retreating from political narratives on the grounds that storytelling is what populists do, we need to reclaim the art of political narrative and open up a space for the expression of political emotions beyond the extremes of fear and adulation alone. So those are my four areas. I'll leave it there.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Over to Matthew. Well, thank you very much, and thank you, Tanya, for that fascinating start. I'm going to wield the journalist's axe in comparison to Tanya's elegant scalpel. What I'd like to do is really just to step back a bit and a little bit back in time, just to frame this whole debate and to try and give a sense of what it is we're dealing with in the whole post-truth debate that has had such a prevalence in the last 18 months. In all the discussions I've had about post-truth in the last year or so, the one that's constantly posed to me is, surely this is nothing new. Lying is as old as human communication, perhaps older. What about blur, people always inevitably say? What about spin? What, after all, about Machiavelli, who rightly said, be a great pretender and dissembler to the prince. This is surely
something that is not new and therefore merely another example of media and intellectual hype. Not surprisingly, take strong issue with that. I think post-truth is something else and it is something new. And the novelty is to be found not in the lies or in the mendacity, but in our response to those lies. It's if you like, not about us. It's not about them, it's about us. Now, as many of you will know, post-truth stormed into kind of public eye in 2016 when it was made Word of the Year. And actually, Oxford Dictionary News, who actually define it rather well as circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. And that, I think, gets right to the heart of the matter. It's as good a definition as I've heard. Why was that the case? Well, two obvious reasons. This is one of them. The infamous battle bus, which made the spectacularly mendacious claim that the Brexit vote would yield £350 million a week for the NHS, a zombie claim that was resuscitated recently by Paul Boris, but remains untrue. Nonetheless, it helped the Leave campaign storm towards a victory of sorts, and reflected, I think, their understanding that emotional resonance and simplicity were more important in a debate that could have descended into a constitutional dryness than kind of bombardment of facts. And what remained wrong was to do precisely that, to believe that statistics would win the day, and they didn't. The only statistic that people really remembered was this one. The fact that it was complete nonsense didn't matter because it spoke very cleverly to the idea that leaving the EU was somehow a vote for the institution that we love best. So, as it were, you take the institution for which Brits probably have the least emotional attachment, and you say that leaving it will give a massive bonanza every week to the institution to which they have most attachment. A very clever, very mendacious, very effective trick. Then, of course, there he is. Part two of the 2016 effect. What is there to say that hasn't been said already? I think the most important thing about Trump in this context, the context of post-truth, is that Americans were very well aware of his character flaws before they voted for him. But he somehow communicated a brutal empathy to them. And that was rooted not in statistics or empiricism or meticulously acquired information, but in a kind of uninhibited talent for rage and an impatience and a genius for the attribution of blame. So the assertion that Trump was plain speaking, a very familiar word in political discourse, came to mean something new. Not as in the past he is speaking the truth, but in Trump's case, this candidate is different and he might just express my anxieties and hopes. And of course, his one of the few, actually, of his original advisors to still be there, Kellyanne Conway, gave us a wonderful addition to epistemological terminology in alternative facts, which really is the heart of the matter. In the post-truth era, what used to be called reality is absolutely fungible. The point is not to determine the truth by a process of rational evaluation, assessment, and conclusion, but you choose your own reality as if from a buffet. So, how has this come about? Well, there are many elements to it. I think one could go into great detail, but I think two very important elements are that there's been a collapse in the social basis of what you might call the truth economy. The trust in traditional institutions has cratered, and the financial crisis of 2008 really took the global economy to the brink of meltdown, and in this country there followed, like dominoes, a collapse of institutions, humiliation of the political class in the parliamentary expenses scandal, scandals in show business, the difficulties my own trade, the print trade, had which led to Leveson, and really that's been mimicked elsewhere in the world. We live in an age of institutional fragility, and a society's institutions act as its guardrails, the bodies that incarnate its values and its continuities, and when those bodies start to fail, the consequences are deeply unsettling. And post-truth has flourished in that context, as the firewalls and the antibodies, if you like, to mix metaphors, have weakened. Second, this is where Obama's quote comes in, digital technology has been the all-important, primary and indispensable engine of the change. In the early years of the online revolution, I think it was optimistically assumed by many, myself included, that the internet would somehow smooth the path to sustainable cooperation and pluralism, and that it remains, I still think, on the credit side of the ledger, but there is no doubt that in practice the new technology, particularly post-2004-05 when broadband became widely available and Facebook was invented in 2004, Twitter was only invented in 2006, a measure of how new all this is, it's done at least as much to foster balkanization and a general retreat into echo chambers, as that quote from Obama rather eloquently explains. So, do we now live in a world of potential anarchy? We certainly live in one where the web tends to amplify the shrill and to dismiss complexity. For many, perhaps most, it encourages confirmation bias rather than a quest for accurate disclosure. It's become a seedbed for conspiracy theories, for pseudoscience, for Holocaust denial. And I really do think it's important to acknowledge that the post-truth theory is emphatically not just about politics. As Andre's excellent book shows, business is yet another area where it has infected. And you'll learn a lot from his book, I think, about the generality of post-truth as well as the specific case of the business world. So there we go. It encourages confirmation bias rather than a quest for accurate disclosure. And it also dramatically reduces accountability because of anonymity. The buzz of the hive sends falsehood fizzing into cyberspace to do its work, with the consequence, more than ever, a lie can travel halfway around the world while trust is putting on its shoes. And in the consequent cacophony, we consume what we already like, we shy away from the unfamiliar, and the ultimate generator of novelty, or at least what was meant to be that, has become the curator of hearsay, folklore, and prejudice. Now, the absolutely crucial point in all of this is it is not a design flaw. It's not a design flaw. This is what the algorithms are meant to do. They are meant to connect us with the things that we like, or might like. They are fantastically, unprecedentedly responsive to personal taste, and to date, fantastically blind to veracity. And the reason that the web is the definitive vector of post-truth is precisely because it's indifferent to falsehood, to honesty, and to the difference between the two. And that, of course, is why fake news, which we've already heard about, became such an issue in 2016. I won't go into that in any detail, except to say it's chilling to record that in December 2016, an Ipsos poll for BuzzFeed of more than 3,000 Americans found that 75% of them who saw fake news headlines judged them to be accurate. So if digital technology is the hardware, post-truth has proved to be a pretty mighty software. It reduces political discourse to a video game in which endless play on multiple levels is the sole point of the exercise. What can be done? Very briefly. The first step is to acknowledge, as many people in the liberal and centre ground that I'm familiar with and comfortable on will not, is to accept that there is no pendulum, there is no inevitable swing back. There will be no automatic correction of what is happening at the moment. That's a misunderstanding of how history works. Second, what I call the scrutiny spectrum, the daily hard grinding work of prosaic activity that ranges from fact checking, in some cases litigation, the right kind of regulation, which each nation and then perhaps at a supranational level will be developed in the next 4 or 5 years. And above all, the quest for digital literacy. I think it should be a compulsory subject from primary school onwards, because our children will not just have to be citizen journalists, but citizen editors. As I say in point three, tech giants self-regulation, if possible, under threat of regulation almost inevitably. And we wait to see how far they're willing to go. I think they know the party is over, but quite how much they're willing to constrain that party yet to be seen. And finally, and interesting that Tanya come up with exactly the same conclusion, the fact's not enough. Post-truth will not tumble under the bombardment of data. Facts need to be communicated in a way that recognises emotional as well as rational imperatives. And this means politicians and others aligning factual claims with emotional significance. That doesn't mean sacrificing veracity to theatricality, but it means more than rapid rebuttal. And I think that's why it's incredibly important that we understand that this is a cultural phenomenon which will require a cultural response. My favourite quote in the whole of politics is Benjamin Franklin, who's accosted by a lady as he was emerging from the second drafting, and he was asked, so what manner of government have you bequeathed this, Dr. Franklin? And Franklin drew himself up to his full height and said, well, madam, a republic, if you can keep it. And the question here really is as simple as that. Can we keep it? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. And everybody coming in on or under time. This is fantastic scheduling. So now over to Juliana Reinecke.
Great, thank you. I'm presenting, I should say, some collaborative work with my co-author, Mikkel Flyverboom from Copenhagen Business School, published in Organization Studies. And so I think, you know, when we talk about post-truth, I think one of the questions that we should probably ask is, what do we mean by truth? The classical correspondence theory of truth assumes that truth has to do with correspondence to some sort of objective reality and the accurate representation of that reality in, you know, thoughts, words, images, and so on. But, you know, that raises questions. What is reality? What is representation of reality? And the notion of post-truth alludes to a certain sense of the boundaries between reality and representation, between fact and fiction, between substance and appearance, become increasingly blurred, and therefore this interrogating this relationship between the real and the representation seems to be really important. Are representation faithful mirrors of reality or attempts to conceal reality? Do they replace reality or bring new realities into being? And I'd like to consider three possible answers. And to do so, I first want to revisit Guy Debord's thesis of the society of the spectacle, which he declared slightly over 50 years ago in 1967, where he suggested in societies where modern conditions of production prevail, all of life presents itself as an immense accumulation of spectacles. Everything that was directly lived has moved away into representation. So his conceptualization of the spectacle provides a forceful critique of this alienated appearance of reality about how representation and appearance mystify and conceal material reality. And he would say that our predicament about post-truth is maybe just the latest manifestation of spectacular society in whose fabrication all of which are already involved. So the notion of the spectacle builds on Marxist political economy, which distinguished, of course, between, you know, the appearance, such as the commodity form, and the underlying reality, the essence. Guy Debord extends Marx's view of commodity fetishism and suggests that commodity fetishism has moved through mass media and advertising and so on into the realm of consumption as well. And so he argues that the spectacle corresponds to the historical moment at which the commodity completes its colonization of social life. And so authentic social life has been replaced by its representation. So the spectacle is a sort of extreme form of commodity fetishism, whereas life becomes subsumed to mere image, but in a way that image becomes real beings. Appearance is preferred over reality, the sign over the signifier. And I apologize, I didn't quote this. So he in his preface to the second edition, De Boer quotes Feuerbach's preface to the second edition of The Essence of Christianity. The present age prefers the sign to the thing signified, the copy to the original, representation to reality, the appearance to the essence, truth decreases and illusion increases, so that the highest degree of illusion comes to be the highest degree of sacredness. So the idea is that we kind of place some value on image rather than substance. So we see this when, you know, organizations channel ever greater resources in how, you know, they represent themselves into brand images, advertising, strategic circulation of stage narratives to help solidify some sort of image spectacles of the organization. And of course, today a whole organization has emerged that also allows, you know, people to render themselves and their lives spectacular through Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and so on. And so, you know, De Boer would probably be very astounded of how, you know, we are incentivized to commodify our own friendships, relations, opinions, emotions by creating these spectacular representations of ourselves. But why De Boer kind of was hanging on to this sort of old-fashioned concept of reality, this view of spectacle can be taken further into an even more provocative direction. Maybe there is no outside reality that the spectacle disguises, and the search for this sort of backstage reality will circle around an endless series of front stages. Maybe the spectacle is all there is. So this kind of more postmodern version really finds expression in the work of Jean Baudrillard, who proposes an even more radical ontology that takes De Boer's analysis one step further. So Baudrillard declares the death of reality by arguing that the distinction between the real and its imaginary, between sign and signified, becomes effaced in the contemporary era. So the real is not only that which can be reproduced, but that which is always already reproduced, so the hyper-reality. So society has become organized by these models of a real without origin or reality behind us. So the hyper-real is beyond representation. It's all there is. So the distinction between reality and the model becomes eroded, and reality is perpetually unknowable and reinvented as fiction. So, you know, reality television, for instance, the archetype of that sort of hyper-reality, which at one level, of course, is based on real footage. But on the other level, it's kind of edited and scripted and performed as some sort of reality TV. So another claim that Baudrillard made was very provocative. He claimed that the Gulf War did not exist in 1991. By that, he meant that, of course, our access to the event, to the Gulf War, to the reality, was always already mediated by the way the images, the reporting, and so on was presented to us, and kind of a crafted storyline out of the selective usage of, you know, this vast, unusable surplus of recorded images. Of course, the fact that, you know, we seem to embrace that sort of fabricated reality without even a pretense to an original opens up these unprecedented opportunities for spectacular reproduction. Copies of an original are not only endlessly reproducible, but these copies are sent into circulation without the need of actually being, of there actually being original. I don't have the presentation with the images. But an interesting example is the Japanese pop star hologram, Hatsune Miku. I don't know if anyone knows this, but it's this kind of humanoid projection that provides the music industry with this, you know, complete hyper-real pop star. And she's going to tour stadiums. She's filling stadiums, touring in the U.S., and of course, her image is fully controllable and provides an endlessly reproducible product. And what seems to be striking is the fact how comfortable we have been with this sort of fakeness in our own lives. So social media users often create fake accounts or maybe even, you know, second accounts, multiple accounts to explore alternative versions of their own selves. And so we have explored potential identities. And some people might even identify more with their fabricated social media identities than with their actual real selves. One just has to look at how, you know, the media turned Donald Trump's 2016 U.S. presidential campaign into a major spectacle, and where his claims, they bore little, you know, if any relation to reality, and this fantastical claim, for instance, that, you know, U.S. President Obama, at that point, was a Muslim born outside the U.S., resonated with many Americans, even though many of them knew that this was utterly invented. But I think this instance of post-truth politics really illustrates how truth is intentionally falsified and how people knowingly choose to accept illusion as reality. The final position that I'd like to consider is the idea of the spectacle as performative. So the notion of performativity is one way of how the spectacle can produce a different world, which is built on, you know, Austin's work on performative utterances, where he describes speech acts that do not simply convey a fact or a lie, but they do something. Like the classic example, I declare you husband and wife. It doesn't say anything about representing reality, but it does something to reality, performs reality. So from that perspective, these kind of spectacles that do things, and reality comes into being through attempts to represent it. One example is the historian Louis Marin, who argued that the power of the Sun King in 17th century France was performed through the portrait of portraying the Sun King through kind of aristocratic imagery, extreme extravagance, royal sway, where the representation creates power. Final example could be that of Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. Of course, you know, money was the ultimate commodity in Marxist terms. And money used to simply represent a fixed quantity of gold that was held somewhere in some government reserves. And as nations abandoned the gold standard, that money came to stand for paper money itself. Yet there was still this idea of, you know, making claims to some referent behind. If you look at the £20 note, where the image of the Queen is there and the claim, I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of £20. But the idea of the Bitcoin is it not only abandons the referent to precious metal, but the very, you know, pretense to such a referent. So I think in sum, there are different possible ways for how we can think about this relationship between the real and the representation of the real and the implications for the possibility of truth. And with that, I'd like to end.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much, Juliana. And our final panelist is Andre Spicer.
So, thank you. I'm going to speak about a book which came out late last year where I look at some of these questions in the context of business, which I and many else of you have been sort of subjected to this kind of nonsense vocabulary we often call management speak. In the early 1980s, the Pacific Bell Company was almost a kind of monopolistic provider of utilities, particularly phone utilities in California. It was a sleepy company. They could do pretty much what they want and make money. But like many other organizations, it was subjected to the rigors of competition in the mid-80s. And part of the response to this is that the people running the organization, the senior executives, wanted to change these gray-suited, boring engineers who ran the company into exciting, grasping, new dimensional business people. So they brought in a consultant by the name of Charles Crone, who was inspired by this chap, George Gudriev. For those of you who don't know, George Grigoriev is a Russian mystic who inspired, among others, Catherine Mansfield, Lloyd Wright, the architect, and many others. He prescribed a mixture of mystical dancing, strange orations, and all sorts of other things. This slowly came into the world of Silicon Valley and the technology world, and here it ended up in a large utility company where it was enforced upon 40,000 employees with a kind of training program which cost, I think, it was targeted to cost something like 100 and something million US dollars at the time. So they began training every single employee. This was the response. They wanted to wake up the sleeping people and bring them into a new state of consciousness through training them in a new language of corporate hippiedom. They used language like this, alignment. They wanted to create end-state visions. They wanted to sketch paths forward, purposefulness, and intentionality. This was the response of the employees working there. I remember periodically having outsiders at our meeting, and they could absolutely not follow a meeting held in Crone. They called this language Crone after Charles Crone, the consultant who ran it. It led to a lot more meetings. Everything took twice as long. If the energy had been put into Crone that had been put into the business at hand, we all could have got a lot more done. Now, I'm sure many of you in the audience begin recognizing some of this now. This croning initiative was initially, it became a statewide scandal. There was extensive reporting on it in the San Francisco Chronicle. It eventually led to the Sacramento government having a large-scale inquiry, and it was closed down it cost something like $30 million before it became costed more. So it was closed down, but it had a longer history. It eventually led to one of these, this character here, who was working at Pacific Bell during the time, by the name of Scott Adams. And if any of you know Scott Adams, he went on to publish these cartoons, the Dilbert cartoons, while he was working at this organization being croned. So if this language has given us anything, it's given us the ultimate mockery that we still find on our cubicle walls around the world. But it's also given us this. The language you, unfortunately, are probably all too aware of. We talk about work activities being thought showers, deep dives, and bio breaks, which, by the way, going to the toilet. A job title could be a thought leader, an innovation sherpa, or a product evangelist. To get fired, you might be right-sized, resource redeployed, or have an object into some opportunity creation. In the UK, Ministry of International Development, which until recently was run by the business bullshitter par excellence Priti Patel, you can get fresh ideas to the table by having outcome-focused models. You'd think that some other parts of our government, such as MI5, might be more sensible, but no, you're wrong. They do horizon scanning, backcasting, and have stovepipes. The NHS is replete with this stuff where they hire quality sensors, lean ninjas, and they can do some blue sky thinking after a bit of a ninja fight or whatever. In our schools, we have grit, flipped learning, and mastery. And this is the response of one school child to their lessons when they were asked, "What do you do at school?" Well, we get to class, we get out our books, and we start on our non-negotiables. So it seems that not only we are learning it, but our kids are learning it even quicker. So the argument which I want to make is that today many organizations that we work in run on this bullshit. This is empty talk without facts, logic, or meaning. Business bullshit is most common in organizations which are full of attention-seeking people who do bullshit jobs where they're expected to be excessively polite while doing it. These organizations become loaded down with bureaucracy, are under constant pressure to change, often to stay the same. This has upsides. It makes you look good and it increases your sense of confidence. But it has massive downsides, alienating employees, overloading organizations, destroying trust, and often leading to the destruction of the organizations this language hopes to provide, to continue. So I'd like to make a claim that we need to cut back this business bullshit by decreasing bullshit production, circulation, and consumption. Let me just briefly take you through this argument. I think all of us probably would have a sense or a smell for bullshit, but I think three red lights are there any facts or actual things described when someone is talking? You know, places, people, numbers. The second thing is there basic simple logic at work, or is there a simple random collection of ideas? The third thing is, does this make any sense to you, or is there any procedure where you can intersubjectively, through discussing with each other, establish some meaning around it? And if it's no, and sorry, if it's no, no, and no, I think you might have a bit of brown stuff on your hands. So why is there so much bullshit in our organizations? I think one of the central drivers are the attention-seeking individuals, often reluctant attention seekers. All of us are encouraged to develop a brand me, get attention for ourselves, get attention for what we do in order to justify what we're doing, often reluctantly. So the best way to do this often is to bring out a few words we don't even understand ourselves. The second response is the rise and extreme expansion of what David Graeber, who works here, calls bullshit jobs. These are jobs which the person doing thinks should not exist. A survey which was recently done in the UK found that 37% of UK people said society would be better off if my job did not exist. What do you do when you're in this? And by the way, it's 42% for men. But what do you do when you're in these one of these positions of bullshit jobs? Well, you often spend a lot of time circulating, consuming, and using this bullshit, sometimes to delude yourself that your job is meaningful, sometimes simply to pass the time. The second response is if you're in one of these bullshit jobs, one of the central things which you need to do is to perform politeness. We all, human nature, is to be a bit polite sometimes. So when you're flung a little bit of bullshit in your way during a meeting, you always nod, shake your head, look down back at your phone, and sometimes you have an assumption that the other person will put up with your bullshit as well. The third driver of this often is excessive bureaucracy in organisations. We're told that we live in a post-bureaucratic time, but as any serious scholar of public administration will tell you, we've had a massive expansion in bureaucracy. Often these people have simply been called business transformation agents, and it's disappeared into the IT infrastructure, and often this comes in the form of having to comply with various bullshit things. And then, as well as the rise of bureaucrats, we've seen the rise of what I call neocrats, so people whose central job it is to create pointless change, which often leads to no change whatsoever, whether that's introducing a new transformation change initiative, bringing in some new plan or something like this, like for those of you who watch W1A, these characters, rather clueless branding agents do at the BBC. Now, is bullshit so bad? Fonzie says yes. It's sometimes not so bad after all. Sometimes it can be very helpful at creating a sense of facade when you're faced with increasing demands from all directions, from all stakeholders, to be both ethical, highly profitable, and also very rigorous and risk-averse at once. A little bit of bullshit doesn't go astray in organisations, and I'm sure each one of us in this room has used it once or twice to avoid a sticky situation. The second thing is that it helps us to build a sense of certainty and a sense that we can actually do something, a kind of image that we are actually useful. So there's a lot of work on entrepreneurs that shows that use of entrepreneurial jargon, i.e. entrepreneurial bullshit, is often very useful, not at necessarily convincing people that their pitch is good, but convincing themselves that it's a good idea. And the final thing is that in an organization where people are doing often very similar kinds of tasks, that there's constant need for sort of downsizing, it helps you to stand out and brand your initiative, which is often quite boring and deadly and uninteresting to others, as something which others should be interested in. But there's a downside. This downside is that often it creates endemic stupidity in organizations. Bullshit means that we're not able to learn from our mistakes. We simply kind of cover it up with empty language, which it's designed not to be understood. The second thing, and I think this is the most worrying, is that it overloads our organizations massively. If we look at schools in the UK, the average teacher teaches face-to-face 16 hours a week, and they work a 48-hour week. If you look at Finland, the world's most, according to many, high-performing, or maybe it's two or three down the ranks now, the teacher works 31 hours a week and they spend 21 hours face-to-face. So then you have to ask, what are the rest of the time that our school teachers are doing? What are they doing? They're disciplining pupils, yes, but they're also dealing with an increasing amount of various change initiatives, new forms of government policy, basically new forms of bullshit, which they're having to eat up. The same is true in many universities. I've written an article for The Guardian a few months, in the summer actually, which went around the world somehow, which seemed to touch a nerve, making this point as well. Universities are increasingly running on large amounts of BS, which we scholars have to kind of deal with this rather than teaching research and doing other things more meaningful. And I think then it begins to undermine trust in organisations. So this is a picture which you probably have felt once or twice when you've got on the phone to your electricity provider or even your organisation waiting for the IT help desk to come back, and you get hit by this sort of sense of meaningless language. We often begin to lose trust when we go into a bank, and instead of being able to open an account, this actually happened to me, you're told, well, we're trying to facilitate customer service and make it more of a delightful experience to be here. We just want to make it feel awesome for you. Well, I just like to open a bank account rather than have to be hit with these words. So I'll leave it there to ponder on. Thank you.
Hey, thanks very much, Andre, and the other speakers. And, you know, everybody has been very concise and sharp and stuck to the time, so we have lots of time for discussion. So, do we have roving mics? Yes, we do. So we have microphones at your disposal. I'd like to invite questions in. I'll take a round of three questions and then allow the panelists to respond. I will try to be reasonably even-handed in choosing questioners, but if there is a surplus, I will positively discriminate against people who tend to speak less in such public gatherings. I'd like you to try and keep your questions nice and sharp and concise, like our speakers have been. So, any offers? I think we had one here. One over there, and the gentleman in the second row here. If you just also very briefly, if you're not too shy, introduce yourself.
So I am Anna. I just moved to the UK. I'm very fresh to the whole experience of 42% of the people just live for the weekends and hate their jobs. I want to thank all the panel. It's been a wonderful presentation for everyone. My question is to Andre about the bullshit job phenomenon. Something that I, someone who has worked in numerous bullshit jobs, has always wondered about it, was that how do companies keep this up? Like, the overhead that just simply my job causes, and I would feel that around 40% of the people I work with could be made right-sized. How does this work? How is it worth it for them?
Do you can we just collect them? So we can, it should go a bit quicker. Gentlemen.
Hello, Alex McCausland, software developer. I'd like to make a defense of alternative facts. We all choose which facts to select and which to ignore that's just a conversation, that's a debate. That's just how these things work. Isn't the problem the fact that we live in this partisan age where we're ready to accuse each other of lying and jump on sound bites rather than the true meaning of what people are saying?
Thank you. And if you can maybe just pass the mic forward. Thank you.
Thanks. Graham Lacey, former head teacher. Two questions on bullshit. First, is one of the reasons for an increase in bullshit that it's a reflection of our educational system, that we have failed to teach the craft of expressing ourselves clearly and simply and have to resort to jargon to appear sophisticated? And secondly, you mentioned several bad things about bullshit. Does the increase of bullshit have any sinister consequences in the way that the post-truth world we live in might lead to?
Thank you very much. I think a couple of those questions were directed to Andre, but also after Andre has responded, maybe we could go in reverse order, and if any of the other panelists want to add something, please go ahead. So, and we'll have another round of questions in a second.
So why bullshit? I was going to ask you the question, do you work in a financial organization? According to Graeber's new book, this is the greatest concentration of bullshit. You'd expect it in the media, but no. So the argument is that when I've spent probably two decades now studying organizations, and one of the central kind of premises that organization theory is based on is that organizations are designed, they're about efficiency, right, and achieving objectives. They're not. They're often more about padding out departments. They're more about kind of keeping themselves going, and you need to show growth, you need to show extension. And one of the basic problems that organizations have is that how do you deal with surplus, right? And they often have surplus positions, surplus jobs, and how do you create kind of image which makes you look like you're efficient and effective and large and impressive, rather than actually do anything. Most of the time, actually achieving things is a secondary or third consideration. And in many ways, this is, I think, what Juliana was sort of pointing out. It's about image manufacturing rather than actually manufacturing products, services, or processes. The second question, which was about the sinister consequences and of business bullshit, I think in many ways it can have a very sinister consequence in terms of the costs and loads it creates on our educational institutions, on our so the people who actually educate it, and also the kind of creep away from actually public services delivering what they're supposed to do, right? To do what they're supposed to do, and it then means that they do all sorts of other things rather than teach children, or the fire services does all sorts of other things rather than put out fires, etc. So it can be very, very pernicious and problematic. And I think when this comes into politics, it can have an even worse consequences, which means that we don't learn from our mistakes. We rather retreat into empty language. I'll leave the kind of question about how the education system might be changed to perhaps some of the other panelists, but good question. Thank you.
Liana or Tanya or Matt, you want to add something?
Mm-hmm. I can say something on the alternative facts bit. I'm not sure necessarily that I agree with the idea of a defense of alternative facts, but what I would say is I think we could be better at telling the story of the production of facts and statistics in public discourse. So there's always a story behind how a statistic, say, is produced. It tends to be produced through contestation, but actually what ends up in a headline is one number rather than a range of possible numbers or percentages, let's say. So I think we could be better at telling those stories, and also, I guess this links to the education bit as well, making that clear within education that facts are produced through contestation, and there are differences in opinions among experts about them as well. But clearly there are some things like dates, for example, that are not really open to alternatives, I think.
Maybe one thing about the kind of sinister consequences of bullshit, because I think, you know, maybe in, you know, spectacular society, we become kind of so used to and so expected to constantly portray a certain positive image representation of ourselves that at some point, you know, in our private lives, in our professional lives, that maybe we just become, we stop questioning when somebody else does it because it just becomes like this expectation that we have to do it, you know, always, aggrandize a little bit ourselves and what we do professionally, that, that maybe we kind of grow a culture in which this is just the expectation. Everybody just kind of feeds into this knowing that, this kind of living collective lie around just bullshitting around.
Yes, really good questions. Briefly, on the question of alternative facts, I think that it's important to understand what was originally intended by that phrase. Of course, what you describe is absolutely legitimate. For instance, there was a big debate about how it's best to describe the deficit. Should you describe it as a percentage of GDP or as an absolute figure? That's a legitimate argument. But it's not an argument about facts. What Kellyanne Conway was trying to do was defend the then press secretary, Sean Spicer's, claim that more people had attended Trump's inauguration in 2016 than had attended Obama's first inauguration in 2009. Now, one of those statements is false, and one of them is true. It's not open to negotiation. And what she was proposing was a situation, as I said in the presentation, where reality was fungible. You can choose Sean's or you can choose yours. It doesn't really matter. And I think that's a very sinister direction to go down. On the question of education, I am very glad that was raised, because I do think, I'm a trustee of the Science Museum, and therefore I spend a lot of time trying to persuade children to do STEM subjects. But I'm also keen that, they not lose sight of, and schools not lose sight of, critical thinking and textual analysis and the tools that they'll need to enable them to be discerning citizens, that give them, if you like, the immune system against this kind of jargon. It's very easy to lose sight of the value, the civic value of those skills, because they don't fit into grades and the kind of targets around which education is regrettably built, sector education is regrettably built now. But they're so incredibly important in the preparation for citizenship that our children are going to have in the rest of this century. On the question of the sinister consequences of bullshit, well, I mean, I think you only have to look at what happens when language descends into euphemism and evasion. Civilian casualties become collateral damage. Torture becomes enhanced interrogation. Look at the warnings of Margaret Atwood and Orwell. You turn the tearing apart of a body into a participation. You describe an execution as a salvaging, or in Orwell's book, you invent a ministry of love, and you declare a reduced ration to be double plus good. It's perfectly clear where bullshit leads if it's unhindered. It's extreme. It's very funny, and one of the points Andre makes very well in the book, and one I agree with, is that satire is a very important tool in undercutting this. But it's also, as he goes on to say, important to take it very seriously as well.
Great, thank you very much. So yeah, we could take another round. So front row over there, we have gentlemen just over here, and I have a bunch of people in the middle. It might take a couple of rounds to get everyone in, but we'll start with the chap there at the back. Can you just briefly say who you are and fire into the question?
Yeah, hi. My name is Nora. I'm a master's student here at LSE, but I was previously worked as a journalist in the U.S. for 3 years. So my questions are for Matthew about some of the solutions you proposed, particularly about the regulation of both the scrutiny spectrum and the kind of concept of fact-checking versus tech giants. You suggested the concept of a supranational body regulating or in some way handling scrutiny, i.e. I would assume in a sort of media way, but then suggested that tech giants ought to self-regulate. Why should we expect one industry to be self-regulating and one industry to kind of supersede some power to another body? And my second question, sorry to do the two-question thing, is just could you speak a little bit more about why you don't think the pendulum will swing back, why that is a logical falsehood? Thank you.
Thank you. One down here.
Hi, my name is James Burgess. I'm a journalist, and I was interested in the two of the solutions that have been proposed by a couple of the speakers around facts and narrative. I wonder if revival of some interest in mainstream journalism is one of the solutions. Is there an opportunity for presenting facts and an appetite for people to have an independent editorial expert who will do that work for them? And around narrative, I was curious to get the panel's view on why they think the right has been much more successful in presenting a narrative that people find appealing.
Thank you. And third one over here.
Thank you very much for your comments earlier. I appreciate it. And my question is, do you think that this is a partisan issue? And the reason I ask that is that the examples that are always provided seem to be from one of the camps. Usually we're talking about 2016 and the two big events that happened in that year. Or maybe it's just me and I'm seeing one side of the story when there's actually two being presented. Thank you.
Great, thank you very much. Good questions. So I guess I think some of those were directed to Matthew, so he wants to start, and then the rest of the panelists can chip in as they do.
Well, there's so much there, I can't do everything. I'll try not to do nothing. On the question of the tech giants, this hangs in the balance at the moment, I think. Throughout all of this, my greatest fear has been that we would end up with governments introducing a ministry of truth, which I think we can all agree would be the worst possible solution, or an off-truth regulator. That is not the answer to the post-truth crisis. But it is actually a less distant one than you might think, because politicians are waking up to the fact that this is beginning to create social unease, particularly over what comes through our devices and the impact it has on the vulnerable and perhaps the not so vulnerable. My hope is that the tech giants are serious in their claims that they will self-regulate. I wonder if that's a triumph of hope over experience. What I do know is they won't do anything unless the bomber planes of official regulation are not circling over their heads. That's as far as I can really go at the moment. I'd like to see them self-regulate. I'd like to see them clean their act up. I'd like to see them behave in a civic and responsible fashion. I don't think they'll do that without the threat of the stick. That's where we're at 2018. You know, we can reconvene in a year or two and then perhaps the answer will be different. On the question of why I think the pendulum won't swing back, I've never believed in the pendulum. I think that it's a relic of Cold War thinking, that there is a kind of swing back between two poles of social norm, and that society corrects itself. I think society is more geological than that, or to put it another way, history moves sequentially. We live in the post-Blair era, then Cameron was post-Blair, then now we live in the May era, and something will follow that. It doesn't seem to me axiomatic at all that what follows Trump will be a nice thing, better than Trump. It might be worse than Trump. I'm not saying it will be, by the way. But there's a deadly assumption in all of this that a terrible mistake was made in 2016 that... actually, it's borrowing an old left Trotskyite idea of false consciousness. The blinks will fall from the eyes of scales will fall from the eyes of the American people, and they realise how foolish they were in 2016, and in 2020 or 2024, elect someone really nice. That may happen, and Godspeed if it does. I mean, I would love that to be the case. I just don't agree with the automaticity of it. I don't feel the rush of a pendulum swinging towards me, and if I'm wrong, that's one occasion where I would be happy to be wrong. On the question of what are the right wings so much better, well, I'm not sure they are actually. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn did a pretty good job, didn't he, in June, of persuading everyone that if they voted for him, everything would be better. I was very impressed, and I mean, he was a guy who was almost out of a job less than 12 months before, coming into an election where every pundit and pollster said he had no chance at all, touring the country with a very simple message that things could get better. And he pulled it off. It was an amazing narrative triumph, absolutely extraordinary, which continued, by the way, after the election, with his absolutely emotionally spot-on response to the Grenfell tragedy, which in many respects I think was more important than the election as an event this year. So I don't think it's confined to the right, although I think that the right has always been nastier, and the right will do anything. The left thinks it's already right, so it sometimes takes longer to get there. But I think that the overriding problem in all of this is the problem with populism. And populism's great danger is the idea that there are simple solutions to complex problems. And that is the infection that is now bipartisan. And it is extremely dangerous. Because, surprise, surprise, complex problems have complex solutions. Brexit The one thing we know about Brexit, it's going to be bloody difficult, but it was proposed as a light switch moment. Leave Europe and everything will be wonderful. And look at the extraordinary difficulty. Who knew? Who knew that leaving Europe would be difficult? And yet, it was presented with great elan as this extraordinary act of emancipation, the throwing off of the manacles. And I think that within that idea lies huge danger, because there is always this, it sows the seeds of even deeper disenchantment further down the line.
I just want to mention one thing that the partisan issue kind of reminded me of, and I risk going off tangent just a little bit, but I think one of the interesting things is that I think what we really witness is this extreme polarization, where I think people just literally live in parallel realities, and I think what we kind of see is that we're losing the public sphere. And this is kind of the idea that, you know, was very much central to kind of the philosophy of Jürgen Habermas, who really related the idea of the public sphere to the possibility of democracy. And the idea in a public sphere was really that you have, you know, kind of some forum where different views can come together. And the issue was around rational deliberation and of considering these different viewpoints and then coming to some sort of, you know, common idea of how do we want to live together. And I think where public broadcasting comes in and so on and so on. And I think with these digital technologies, where most people, I think at least in the US, get their news from Facebook and live in the echo chambers and little bubbles and so on, I think suddenly it becomes not about, you know, rational deliberation, but all this about storytelling and narratives and so on, which I feel slightly uncomfortable about, that it's not just about, you know, how do we tell better stories to reach people in their little worlds that they now live in. And I think there's this broader issue that how do we kind of maybe recreate a public sphere where we can debate issues of, you know, living together as a society, where people don't seem to communicate on the same platforms anymore, or at least maybe the same platforms but not the same, kind of don't join the same conversation.
Just on the point about industry self-regulation, I guess my fear would be that if we don't have an approach that brings in various different groups into finding the solution, that Facebook then ends up having or being the Ministry of Truth rather than governments. So I think maybe it needs to be a kind of more multi-dimensional approach. And then on the point about populism, I absolutely agree with that, the kind of promoting this simple narrative to deal with very complex realities. I would also say that technocracy carries that risk as well, which is to hold up a simple, they would say a complex, nonetheless, a single technical solution to complex social challenges as well. So I think that's why the narrative dimension is so important, because we need to kind of reopen those spaces for public deliberation rather than simply one populist response or one technocratic response.
Great, thank you. Andrew? You going to pass? Okay. More questions. So we had a few stood up. So the gentleman just in here, maybe at the back there, so that's two. I think there was another hand up somewhere around here that I skipped last time. Gentleman just in front here. So, yeah, you go first.
Hi, thank you. The stuff on spectacle and performance really resonated, and I think in terms of what we see from Donald Trump, he very much does seem to create reality that then everyone else needs to deal with. So I suppose the challenge that I would be keen to hear you, your thoughts on, though, is that if challenging that with facts isn't enough and we need a narrative, how can that be done in a way which is powerful enough to provide that opposition without kind of going down a rabbit hole where essentially you kind of seed the facts altogether? Because, as you said, they are very complex issues, but if someone is creating a reality of simple solutions, I've struggled to kind of understand how you combat that, as I say, without completely ceding the facts and losing that ground altogether.
Thank you. You just pass it forward. Gentleman just in front of him, yeah, thanks.
My name's Chris Churchill. I'm going to claim full house as a financial IT consultant. But we seem to be defining bullshit and post-truth as almost polar opposites. I mean, that bullshit is the excessive complexity to obfuscate, and the post-truth is the very simple, even when that's not appropriate. But, so I'm taking myself back to bullshit, if I may, because someone to separate those two. As a seasoned user, moving from IT jargon to consultancy bullshit, you do it because the benefits are greater than the cost. So how will we ever stop it? How will we ever make the costs greater than the benefits?
Thank you. Yep. And the question back there.
Hi, my name is Eliana. I'm kind of new from London. I'm new to London. So my question is a little bit similar. And people's emotions always get ahead of their thinking. So we talk about education, we talk about self-regulation, but there's always that kind of addicting mob mentality and anger that kind of springs forth. And it kind of goes along with the sensationalism of 24-hour news. I think that has a lot to do with the whole fake news phenomena, because you can't have something happening everywhere 24 hours, so you have to make everything sensational. So that feeds into this anger. So how can we solve that sort of component of it, like the 24-hour news, the fact of mob mentality, and of course, you know, the effectiveness. If you want to bring someone down, you know, you shame them, you call them, now it's very popular to call someone a Nazi if you don't like them, or a racist, you know, automatically, even without proof. And of course, people's anger is immediate. The 24-hour news jumps on it with their sensationalism. So how do we deal with that component of it?
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So, Andre, do you want to start?
Yeah.
And we'll move that way.
So one sort of thought I had is this kind of idea of, are facts enough to make these arguments? And one response to that is, I think sometimes we need to kind of frame things in practical terms, right? So there's a social psychology experiment I've sort of come across recently which poses to people the toilet test, which is you get people into a room and you say to them, okay, how much do you know about toilets? And most people say, well, I use them pretty much every day, so I know about 9 or 10 from a 1 to 10 scale. And then you say to them, okay, so tell me precisely how does a toilet work, right, in as much detail as possible. And then people have to go, well, I'm not really sure, and this is very difficult, and, you know, et cetera. And then you ask them again, how much do you know about toilets? And then they often say 3, 4, something like this, right? And you can do this with almost any claim, particularly in organizations where the CEO comes in and, oh, yeah, let's implement a new IT system or this or that, which is good. But the difficulty is they don't think through the steps, etc. And the same thing could be said potentially within the political realm. Yeah, let's build a wall, okay? So let's talk about, okay, how are you going to do this and what's the process and all that sort of stuff. And then the practicalities become a little bit clearer. Then to your point, which is about the costs outweighing the benefits, I think there was a few others, you know, towards the end of the book, I kind of make these points of what do we do about bullshit, right? And we can laugh about it, we could use it strategically to undermine organizations, as the CIA sabotage manual from 1944, which you can find online, also suggested. But we can also, I think, do something more constructive about it, which is, first, we try to reduce production. And I think one way in which we can do that is if people take just a little bit of the bullshit out of their job, like cut out one bullshit task, maybe then a little bit of the production might decrease. I think we can cut out circulation, at least reduce the circulation a little bit and slow it down by posing three simple questions. Where are the facts? You know, what are the facts? What's the logic behind that, and what does that actually mean? And I think a lot of bullshit might be stopped at that point. And the final thing is cutting back a bit of bullshit consumption, I think. So sometimes if you look at the kind of demand for it, a lot of it's about kind of corporate escapism, so escaping from the actual problems rather than bigger things. And then perhaps cutting back on some of the degree of insecurity in organizations which lead to these things. So and the final point is putting a cost on it, I think. So
So the biggest difficulty, one of the biggest drivers of bullshit in organizations is the fact that many people who use it, associated with strategies, don't have to actually implement it, right? Which isn't just you, but it's senior managers as well. And you can easily put up a thing if you then run on to the next thing and let someone else take the cost of it failing. So if you want to do something, if you want to suggest it, you should be involved in implementing it.
Thanks. Well, just on the question of Trump, which is really an interesting question. One of my great concerns about Trump is that we've had entertainers who've moved into the world of politics. That's not new. My worry about Trump is that he's actually annexed politics to the world of entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, he thinks in terms of ratings. He thinks in terms of show business. He's more infuriated by Meryl Streep and SNL than he is by A Fall in the Dow. You know, it's no accident that he was interviewed by Piers Morgan. This is not a sideshow. This is how he does business. And so how do we oppose that? How do we move on from it? Well, I think that the key lies in leadership broadly understood and a call to maturity, by which I mean that there's been a debasement in the popular rhetoric, public rhetoric, in the last 40 or 50 years. Can you imagine a politician using the phrase, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country? No special advisor would let that through the first draft. If you look back at the great rhetoricians of the past, Harvey Milk, Martin Luther King, Lincoln, Churchill, all of them made demands. They made demands of people. And actually, I think people respond really well to it. I think that the cosseting of people, that treating them entirely to the point where citizenship is just coterminous with consumerism, actually is not, makes people feel very unhappy and depleted. And this speaks to another point that was made in the question about emotion, which is, yes, there's the polarization of politics and the weaponization of information through social media has created a mob mentality, but it's also created a kind of hypersensitivity, you know, where everyone is constantly bloody offended. You know, everyone is either red-pilled or woke. If I never hear either of those words again, I will be so happy. Woke. Oh, please, give it a break. You know, grow up. Sorry. Public sphere could not agree more. And I think that there's an answer of sorts in that. I think you're going to put a finger on it. We need a new public sphere. But we need a public sphere that is based not on relativism, but on pluralism. We need to renegotiate a set of common rules and practices and habits and civilized practices that mean that we can exist in a pluralistic society without degenerating into a relativistic mob. And this is quite a big ask, but I think that unless you identify the scale of the task, you know, you're going nowhere.
Great, thank you. Anya?
Okay.
Julia?
It's okay, yeah. Maybe we can take it.
Okay, right, we'll squeeze in the last couple of questions. Really quick ones, though.
Can I ask a question?
Andre can ask a question, and then... three really quick questions. Two over there and one here. But super quick, so we can have wrapped up by eight. Andre, you go ahead.
I can skip it.
Okay, you can ask your question in the answers, right? Okay. So starting off here.
Okay.
Yeah,
hi, I'm Lucy Matthews. I'm studying MA Terrorism, Security and Society across the street at King's KCL. So I'm kind of viewing a lot of this discussion through sort of the combating terrorism lens, and I've been reading a lot in my program about the sort of terrorist organization and extremist use of the internet and online and forming of communities and propagating, you know, certain narratives online. And so the discussion about sort of the increasing polarization that much of this is causing of everyone being in their sort of own silos, you know, brings up to me sort of the dangers of violence that could come out of this sort of very polarized situation. So I just wondered your thoughts about sort of the dangers inherent to this post-truth world and to the polarization, also sort of the status of living in a liberal society, and how do you do anything impose regulations, or should we, or, you know, have just sort of the balance between liberal democracy and, these sort of often extremist or violent beliefs.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Couple of quick ones over there.
Thank you very much. Besides of promoting these kinds of forums, how can the academia, the academic sector, contribute more to avoid these kind of situations?
Thank you. Great. And there was one more at the back. Yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to ask, is the increase in bullshit jobs the result of a need to drive job creation in an economy increasingly affected by automation?
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Thanks very much. Okay, so starting with Julian, and we'll come this way. And short and snappy responses, because we're kind of running up against our deadline.
Yeah. I mean, maybe about the question about academics, it's something that I ask myself every day as an educator. And I think maybe it has to do maybe also for, schools in general, how we really think about education with all the knowledge being there already out there online and so on. And I think, this call to really, critical thinking and making people kind of question news, but also, being able to really go through very kind of complex material, and maybe the ability to kind of, there was another question of how can we, convey this complexity in kind of simple terms. There seem to be kind of new kind of capacities and skills that, I think we really need to endow in people to kind of, live through this world. So I don't really have a ready-made program for that, but I think that's something that I think we, as academics, we all have to think about how we can do this. And I think around the kind of polarization, I couldn't really agree more. And I think it's just, it seems just quite interesting how many things that were just so liberating in the last, decades, this idea of, dismantling the grand narrative that seemed to be stifling, and now we end up with kind of, this extreme polarization of and extreme relativism, and at the same time, digital technology being so liberating, and now it seems to be kind of almost the enemy of liberation. So it's kind of, it just seems interesting so how the kind of developments that we kind of see positive suddenly seem to show their darker sides.
Thank you. Daniel?
Yeah, on the question about terrorism, I think some of the responses that kind of have gained most traction are very much from within our liberal bubble and don't necessarily take into consideration that the people we are dealing with don't necessarily think like us. So the famous kind of policy solution that was put forward, I think in 2008 by Cass Sunstein, was called cognitive infiltration. And he said that, well, he and his colleague Adrian Van Wilt, they said that in online terrorist networks, you could see there was evidence of crippled epistemologies. Very grand title. So basically saying that people didn't have all the facts, and they advocated government officials penetrating these groups, either covertly or not, and simply providing the correct information, and then the problem would go away. Now, clearly, there's lots of laughing in the room. I don't know if they would write that paper today, but I think the fact that that's still perhaps the kind of most famous policy suggestion in that area suggests that